John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're going to talk about super PACs. Since the Supreme Court's ruling on Citizens United, the number of super PACs have exploded, unleashing a tsunami of cash into political campaigns. This hour, we will talk about the influence of super PACs and the 2012 elections, and we'll touch on perhaps what could be considered the lighter side of super PACs as well. My guest is David Weigel, a political reporter for Slate. David Weigel, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn program.
Well, thanks for having me.
The article that caught our eye and got us interested in a program about super PACs was your rather lighthearted article titled "The Colbert Effect, the 14 Silliest Super PACs Actually Registered with the Federal Election Commission." I suppose this was an inevitable development. Somebody is always ready to jump in with something funny or to point out the ridiculousness of a situation like this. What was your favorite out of those top 14?
Oh, boy, it's tough to choose. And they're still adding. I mean, what happened here is that a number of people, not just fans of Stephen Colbert, have been applying for, registering super PACs with the intention of raising no money, just with the intention of amusing themselves or bring more more views to the issue of why these things are so legal. So I guess I'd have to go for Howard Stern fans for Baba Booey tomorrow. It's kind of a nice mixture of an old media joke from the 90s and a new media joke from 2012.
Yeah, I think I mentioned I was rather partial to My Cat Xavier for a Better Tomorrow. But you have to admit that that Patriotic Americans for a More Patriotic and American America sort of hits the spot as well.
I mean, that's good too, because if you talk to Bill Burton, who heads the Democratic PAC Priority USA, I think he said this a couple times. He said it to Robert Draper in the New York Times a little while ago. They're called Priorities USA in part because they kept applying for other names that involve the word America and not getting it. And one thing that is kind of maybe sounds dull, but is revealed every time one of these. I always want to say every time, the process is different now, is just there's this endless stream of sketchy and mysterious organizations with the words America and freedom and tomorrow in them. And if you try to start one, you find that your top 50 ideas have been taken by somebody who wants to buy a candidate in a Nebraska House race or something.
Yeah, Orwell would be proud, I think, to see how the language is twisted around to suit the circumstances. On the more serious side, the Citizens United, there were super PACs before Citizens United. I mean, there were organizations that raised and spent money on behalf of, supposedly not on behalf of candidates, but on behalf of issues. But with Citizens United, we basically just, backed up the dump truck and started pouring cash into this, and it really did change the game, did it not?
It did. I mean, if you looked at Matt Bai tried to do a kind of contrary take on this in the Times last week and argue that nothing much has changed because of the Citizens United ruling. It's not just Citizens United, but Right to Life Wisconsin. There were a pair of Supreme Court decisions that rolled back most of our campaign finance law. But no, I mean, it's useful to compare the current law to what we had before Watergate. We actually have ways of hiding donations in charitable organizations, according to tax purposes, charitable organizations that we didn't have before. I mean, let's look at somebody like Steve Wynn or Sheldon Adelson. If they tried to give to an outside group that was buying ads in 1971, they wouldn't have had the same protection. There wasn't a 501c3 group couldn't have bought ads without revealing who the donors were. I mean, and they would have been investigated, would have gone to jail. I mean, the reason we know so much about the committee to reelect the president is because of the rule that existed then, not anything post facto. So we've actually opened up the path to a lot of secret money. Super PACs eventually have to declare a lot of where their money comes from. The difference is they don't have contribution limits, and that's something that we did have before Watergate, but it's the proliferation, the rules getting in are different now, and also the FEC, I think, is just such a weak organization when it comes to regulating and reporting this stuff. Forgetting the charitable organizations, they've kind of gotten out. But if you look at the FEC's reports on what is and is not a kind of a kosher ad, they take forever to make decisions. They don't report very quickly. They're just, I almost don't think it's even worth talking about loopholes. There is no wall to build loopholes into.
Well, and you mentioned campaign ads. I saw at least one piece of speculation on why the Federal Communications Commission couldn't enforce the actual federal statute against broadcasting false alarms on radio and television. False distress signals are expressly illegal, and someone thought that could be stretched to cover some of these more fear-inducing campaign ads. That'd be an interesting legal question to look at. But while the super PACs are supposed to reveal their donors, sometimes the way the donations come in, it's tough to find the real donor behind all the shell companies.
Yeah, we've saw a lot of examples of that. Not to pick on Mitt Romney, but Mitt Romney has benefited more from this system more than anyone in history. It's a new system. He's got a lot of money. And we saw during the primary, it was possible for a organization to be created, like a company to be created, to give lots of money to a super PAC and then to fold up, and for that company to have almost no—it was almost like Jason Bourne or something. There was no trace of its existence apart from this one line in a paper. Romney, at that point, there's a bit more attention on this. I think was asked a few times, eventually helped suss out who was helping him. But there's nothing, I mean, as we get into the flurry campaign season, there's nothing stopping anyone from doing that numerous times. And people in the current political climate have made it known they want to give millions and millions of dollars to help elect Republicans to various offices. To a lesser extent, they want to help elect Democrats. I'm not being equivocal, because it's just a fact that there are rich, wealthy Democrats who have more of an ethical problem with the system than in a way that wealthy Republicans do not. I mean, Penny Pritzker, who was a big part of Barack Obama's election in 2008, is kind of being brought back in the loop. She's on the Jobs Council, et cetera. But she's one of these people who has just endless bushels of money but doesn't want to give it to a super PAC. It was a real struggle for the Obama PAC to raise this money. And you just don't see that from wealthier interests who think that they really fear that the country will collapse if Barack Obama is reelected. I don't think I'm hyperventilating. You listen to what people have said at closed door or open door conventions or conferences, like the ones that the Koch foundations have. Charles Koch said in 2011 that this is the mother of all battles. 2012 is the mother of all battles. If it's the mother of all battles, it's a fight for your civilization. You're going to, if the lawyer you already have on retainer knows there's a way to hide some money, you're gonna take it.
Yeah, the Citizens United has sparked an effort, well floated by Senate Democrats at least, to propose a constitutional amendment which would would amend the Constitution to make. To make campaign spending limits possible. The Supreme Court says that you can't do it now. Okay, fine, we'll amend the Constitution and we'll fix that leak. That probably has about as much chance of going anywhere in the current climate as ice in Greenland right now.
you used to have a better chance. There used to be more ice in Greenland. There used to be Republicans who believed firmly that the way to fix the system was to allow endless donations but full disclosure. And Democrats have not proposed exactly that, but they have proposed. I think they've missed an opportunity by not proposing exactly what Mitch McConnell, what Mike Pence, and a number of Republicans said a few years ago. They have changed their minds on this. I mean, Mitch McConnell, on a number of issues. I mean, I think the fact that he's always opposed to flag-burning legislation gives him the room to say that he's just a constitutionalist. He's against anything that violates any part of the Constitution. But you know, he used to say that it was worthwhile to if people were going to use their money as speech, worthwhile to know who they are. He's changed his mind. He points to the fact that there are organizations like the Communist Party that, the Socialist Party USA is the one what I'm thinking of, that don't have to disclose their donors because there might be threats against them. You know, I talked to the Socialists a couple weeks ago, and they that's still the position. They don't want to, they're glad they have an FCC exemption to not say who donates to them because those people might be hounded. I'm not as convinced by it. I mean, if you know the history of the FBI in this country, it wasn't exactly hard. It's not exactly hard for people to keep tabs on people who give to organizations they find radical. It's also, I mean, I don't want to soft pedal this, but this country is not racked with threats or assassinations of people who donate to political campaigns. The Koch family, for example, have become very famous for a number of reasons for their political donations. They appear in public. They have not become Howard Hughes types. Their anger and fear mostly comes from the public criticism they've gotten. And, you know, anyone with a certain amount of power gets threats and things like that. But Republicans argue that the threat is just the existence of the threat is a problem, and then the way the First Amendment's written, you shouldn't have to disclose anything. You know, you should have complete secrecy if you want it whenever you're using your money to make a point or using your speech to make a point. You know, I guess they look at David Koch as, you know, Alexander Hamilton writing as Publius or something, and Democrats look at David Koch as
Cardinal Richelieu.
I would guess, well, yeah, that way, but I'm saying they look at him as somebody just using a lot of free speech. Who should get behind it?
The Disclose Act was defeated in Congress last week. Some are saying that Citizens United is not the real problem. Congress is to blame for not requiring disclosure. And Republicans aren't going to go along with any Democratic proposals, regardless of what they are.
Yeah, that's basically true. That's not anything new in this Congress. The sense is that first of all, they don't really have a problem with the system as it is. I mean, John McCain was with a couple of reporters talking to McCain last week, and he gets asked about this because he used to be for, campaign finance reform. This is his law that's been undone, and he just said, I can't find a Democrat to endorse, to go along with me. That beggars a little bit of belief. I mean, there are Democrats like Sheldon Whitehouse who are for disclosure, but I guess his point is that Democrats won't demand the same disclosure from unions that they do from the wealthy, and that's a little bit duplicitous. I mean, unions have more strict disclosure requirements generally. I'm blanking on the exact part of the code, but it's pretty easy to find. Than a wealthy person. I mean, there's nothing theoretically preventing a union from creating a shell organization, but they have to report where their money's going in a way that Sheldon Adelson does not have to report it. But anyway, that's the Republican campaign finance reformer, that's his rationale.
We're talking about super PACs and their impact on the campaign coming up, the campaign we're in the middle of, the never-ending campaign, seemingly, these days, their impact on the political landscape. What do you think? Have you ever donated to a super PAC? I'm wondering what our listeners think about this. Have you ever given money to a super PAC? If so, why? Be interesting to know. 800-486-8655 is the number to call to join the discussion. 800-486-8655, the email address talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also join us on Facebook. There is a Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. You can leave your comment or question there. Again, 800-486-8655. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 22 minutes after 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. This hour we're talking about super PACs, and my guest is David Weigel, political reporter for Slate. So we don't necessarily always know who donates, but sometimes reporters are finding out some of this information. How is it that they find this stuff out? How much digging do they really have to do to get this info? Because it is coming out in large measure.
They do quite a lot. I mean, if you're in New York or D.C. and to some extent Las Vegas, you just hear chatter and you follow up on it. And your reporting involves multiple confirmations, but usually some sort of, not a denial, but a distancing from the person giving the money. I mean, a good example is Ken Vogel, who's probably the best reporter working on this stuff. Nick Confessori at the New York Times, also quite good. Chased down that Steve Wynn, who occasionally has voted for Democrats, he's a casino mogul in Vegas, he's a golden nugget rehabilitator, et cetera, he had been courted by Karl Rove, and he found that out just by talking to people in the Rove circle. I mean, American Crossroads, which is the organization he corrals money for, has staff in D.C. He chased it down. Wynn's office said they don't comment on his private giving. But, you know, there's luck. This is, I think, a pretty good function of the Fourth Estate, is that they're able to chase down a rumor and find out who's behind something. Now, the exact cash amount is tough to confirm, but you know, a good rule of thumb is if somebody writes the article and there's not a retraction, then it's true. The Kochs, for example, through their PR department, are always demanding retractions when people write that they're trying to organize up to $200 million for the campaign, because of this is what they said at a conference, and the conference was off the record. But you know, that's never been retracted because reporters have basically proven it.
Let's take a phone call. We've got full phone banks right now. Let's go to La Crosse and hear from Dan first. Dan, good morning.
Morning. You know, I think the saddest issue surrounding this whole thing are at two levels. One, the unfortunate fact that the American people clearly don't make campaign finance an issue they vote on or really seem to care much about. And the second is the very fact that these ridiculous ads work. I mean, if the ads didn't work, if people actually took the time to educate themselves and make informed votes, the ads wouldn't work. And I realize I'm probably being a bit idealistic, but it's probably the most disgusting part of the whole aspect, is that people allow their minds to be made up by television ads that are clearly not true. I think that's really the saddest part of all.
Dan, thanks for the call. David Weigel, comment?
Yeah, actually, when I was covering the Iowa caucuses, and to a lesser extent other primaries, there are more candidates than Iowa caucuses, I would ask voters if they knew who was behind an ad they were seeing. Because sometimes voters will quote back a line from a TV ad. I mean, that's the point. They're kind of bombarded in this Clockwork Orange way with the stuff. And they wouldn't know. I mean, Restore Our Future, the Romney ad, which is Romney Super PAC, which is kind of a great self-canceling nonsense name for a super PAC. It doesn't. There's nothing about it that says it is pro Mitt Romney. So it would run a negative ad. And it wouldn't have to be connected to the candidate. I mean, this is a feature of McCain-Feingold that's still part of normal law. If I donate to, and I don't donate as a reporter, but if I donate to, you know, Barbara Boxer or something, and she runs an ad, and she says, "I'm Barbara Boxer, and I approve of this message." And the super PAC has to say who they are, but the fact that they're spending all their money, I mean, even if you hear that the Democratic Committee or the Republican National Committee is behind something, it just associates it in a way that a generic super PAC ad does not. And there hasn't been a great study yet of that, but just like my own anecdotal talking to voters, they definitely don't hear that or see those ads and make the connection. I mean, Gingrich's PAC was Winning Our Future, which is actually more of a giveaway than they usually do. There was a Herman Cain PAC that was called the 999 fund. But see, the I almost forgot to mention the irony here. Because they're supposed to be uncoordinated or non-coordinated, and uncoordinated sounds like they have trouble balancing things, they can't actually include the name of the candidate. So you've got this great paradox. The 999 fund, which was the PAC supporting Herman Cain, was originally called Americans for Herman Cain, and they had to change the name because in order to funnel support to Herman Cain, they couldn't include those letters in the name of the organization. That's how wacky this is.
Hmm. You wrote an article back in February suggesting that super PACs were good for democracy. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, at that moment in time, super PACs, I think, were giving a couple of candidates a better chance at surviving the primaries than they would have had before, you know, anonymous donation super PACs. Mitt Romney always, even in 2008, he vastly outspent everybody. Mitt Romney has a lot of personal wealth. He has a lot of great business ties. He, one-to-one, was just crushing every candidate. But Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich, and then to an extent Rick Perry, that didn't really save him, were able to compete with raising a lot of super PAC. With super PAC, spent a lot of money. I mean, Rick Santorum in Iowa, I think his campaign spent less than half of what the Red, White, and Blue Fund, which was the pro Santorum super PAC, spent. I mean, had he not spent that money, it's conceivable that he would have, you know, maybe come in second or third place behind Ron Paul. Paul, the same thing. I mean, there was a Peter Thiel and other donors funded a pro Ron Paul PAC, and Paul is still not dropped out of the race. I mean, he's able to run a pretty large operation where 20 years ago, and Paul's a good example. Paul's been politics for a very long time. 20 years ago, his organization would have had to scale back more because they could only raise money for him. And that was so. In that particular case, it was extending giving more voters a choice by dragging this thing out. Generally, I think if I declare a bias, it's generally towards this idea that you should be able to donate as much as you want, but you have to disclose it. And that is part of democracy. I mean, if money is speech, then you are participating in the process when you give money. I think that's totally fair. And in that case, it was, you know, the super PAC donations were making sure it wasn't just Mitt Romney donors who could decide the election.
Well, if corporations have a right to free speech, do they also have a right to keep and bear arms? I mean, I think someone sent an email to me about that when I mentioned that I was covering this topic today. They said, well, look, you know, if corporations are persons, if they have a right to free speech, what other rights do they have that we don't know about yet? And that was the one that was brought up. But, where does this end? And that probably is a discussion for another day. But the idea that the super PACs and the candidates aren't coordinating at all is one I wonder how many buyers there are for that stock.
I don't think people take it very seriously. If you look at polling, people generally don't like this system. They don't vote on it. I mean, what the caller pointed out, and people don't seem to be voting on this. The time when they did, in 2000, if we remember back that far, it was the economy was fairly decent, and it was in decline a little bit, but look at manageable decline. We weren't facing two wars. It was just, I think another thing is people were less engaged with politics. I mean, we forget the voter turnout in the 2000 election was far below what it was in 2004 and far below what it was in 2008. Voters were less engaged, I think. Politics was irritating, and there was more willingness to restrict the damn ads that were on TV all the time, or at least to find out who was behind them. It's faded. Like, people still believe this. It's just not motivating. I don't think you're going to find many people who cast a presidential vote based on the candidate's relative positions on campaign speech. I've heard this point made, too. I think it's a little bit glib, Barack Obama opted out of campaign finance, public campaign finance in 2008, and had a lot to do with ending that system. I mean, it's cool because George W. Bush did this first, and it's a huge difference when you're talking about a presidential campaign, a victory fund, et cetera, run on donations that have to be declared to the FCC versus the super PAC system. I mean, maybe people don't like money in politics, but one of those is public and declared and has limits, and one has none of those things.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We have callers who want to join us. There's a line available if you'd like to call now at 800-486-8655. Let's go to Ray in Milwaukee first. Ray, go ahead.
I want to strongly disagree with your guess that super PACs do anything beneficial in our election. This flood of money, while children in the city of Chicago cannot walk to school because they actually need the National Guard on the south side of Chicago, this flood of money into this political farce is insane. And by the way, if there is no disclosure and we don't know who's putting money into these funds on the left and the right, this question especially goes out to people on the right who want to have voter ID and are insane that we have this huge fraud in voter ID. Why don't they care if foreigners are funding our elections? Couldn't Vandar Bush, who is, you know, the Saudi prince who was friends with the Bushes, I think he now owns a mansion in Colorado, how do we know his money isn't going in to help Mr. Romney or some other dictators around the world? This is complete giving up our constitutional rights. Where in the Constitution does it say foreigners can fund our elections, and how will we know if there is no disclosure?
I don't know if it's in the... Well, I know there's a law against foreign contributions. Al Gore got in trouble for something. There was a little scandal about that when he was running for president. But what about it? Do we know where this money is coming from all the time? And is it possible that foreign contributions are making their way into these super PACs?
Well, yeah, the way that the Democrats usually approach this is by saying these companies have... I mean, let's look at Mitt Romney's help from Barclays, for example. I mean, this is a bank with a lot of business in the United States, an American chairman, but based in London. I mean, like, while he's in London on this trip, he's going to be raising money with them. And so the question of whether people, you know, some of this money is coming from people who are not American is real. There's not evidence yet of a foreign interest bankrolling somebody. I mean, frankly, given the relative popularity of Barack Obama and the Republican Party, if that was happening, I think Priorities USA would be rolling a lot of money. But no, it's a concern. It's another reason to have less faith in the system. This is why people want disclosure. If there's not disclosure, people wonder. And this is the listener brings up voter ID. Look, a lot of politics, sadly, is trying to find a righteous sounding argument for something that's going to help you politically. And that's voter ID. There are some concerns there, but here you've got a system set up that is going to, in Pennsylvania, Mississippi, a couple other places, doesn't have safeguards to make sure everyone can legally vote. There is, he's right, much more concern among Republicans for making sure people show up with an ID and prove that they can vote than prove where they are when they donate to a campaign. And it's dispiriting. I mean, it doesn't. If you're having a serious discussion about what you think politics should be like, I don't think many people agree that you should be able to stay this anonymous when you're influencing an election.
Let's go to Chuck in Lake Delton next. Chuck, good morning.
Yes, thank you. I just think it's kind of an oxymoron that where these, you know, some of these rich folks can pay, you know, $15 or $20 million to support these candidates like Newt Gingrich or whoever, and still they're crying the blues about paying a little bit more taxes on the wealthy to support our country. I don't get it myself. I can take my comments off the air if you like.
Thanks, Chuck. There is sort of a dichotomy there.
Oh, a little bit. I mean, I think you're hearing a lot of the same, a lot of different elements of the same question here, because it's hard to believe the system works like this. I mean, I don't think we were lulled particularly by McCain-Feingold, but remember, what McCain-Feingold was trying to end the process of soft money, of party organizations being able to raise as much as they wanted without declaring it. And I do think people felt like that, since that problem had been solved, that there, you know, was a little bit of grime taken out of politics, and it's back in there.
Mm-hmm. Sarah in Zion, Illinois, you're next. Sarah, good morning.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. My question is, well, it seems so ludicrous to me that we make these decisions based on marketing, on ads, and I think it's so reasonable to just ban it from TV, and I know that's not likely, but are there any countries? It seems like I've read about some countries that don't allow election advertising.
Yeah, actually, we're all kind of focused on Britain right now. Britain allows just a certain allotted TV time for campaigns. There's a Labour Party broadcast, a Liberal Democratic Party broadcast, a Conservative Party broadcast. The smaller parties that haven't proven the same support level get to give shorter broadcasts. But basically, there's private, and now, you know, in the age of YouTube, you can watch, rewatch these if you feel like it. But people generally would kind of participate in the franchise by watching what the party wanted them to watch. There were strict donation limits. It's actually kind of embarrassing if you look at the scandals in Britain over who's donating how much to parties. I don't think it would fund a average Senate race in Delaware in this country. But very few countries have these kinds of limits. And I'm not trying to talk down the First Amendment. First Amendment is fantastic. It's just that they don't. No other country has quite the same has the same First Amendment tradition that has it that ingrained and has a legal kind of a legal system that will defend the right to give endless amounts of money to a campaign under a free speech argument. I mean, Canada doesn't have that. Australia doesn't have that. Italy even doesn't quite have that. I mean, in order for Italy to have the same sort of, I think, full spectrum dominance by one political donor, you needed to have Silvio Berlusconi become a billionaire and buy a bunch of media stations and control the message himself. Yeah, there's nothing quite like this in the rest of the world.
Yeah, and in England, you have the BBC, which is essentially a government service, and so that kind of takes care of that anyway.
You don't see posters, right. Actually, but you don't see TV ads.
Yeah. All right. 800-486-8655 is the number. We have lines available for you right now if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question about super PACs and their impact on elections. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave a comment or question there. Again, 800-486-8655. My guest, David Weigel, who's a political reporter for Slate. He's written extensively on super PACs and their impact on our elections. We may yet refer back to the article about the top silly names for super PACs, because some people have taken this as an occasion to poke a little bit of fun at the political system, as that's another American tradition, I think. But when we come back, one of the things, David, that we haven't talked about yet is how the Republicans and Democrats differ in terms of how super PACs are used to enforce party discipline, for example. I want to talk about that when we come back. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. My guest is David Weigel, a political reporter for Slate. David, you wrote an article back in May talking about how the Democrats and Republicans differ in the way super PACs operate in the primaries, for example, whereas the Republicans seem to enforce ideological purity, the Democrats are much less likely to do the kind of negative campaigning in primaries that you see see the Republicans going through. Talk a little bit about those differences and how they've played out and how the super PACs have been involved in that.
Yeah, well, this is about super PACs and also about some larger issues. I mean, the Club for Growth is not a super PAC. Club for Growth is a 527, has a 527 that's been around for more than a decade and exists to make sure that the more conservative Republicans win primaries. They interview the people. If they like them, if they're convinced that they can win, they pour money into the campaign, and they helped. I mean, there are newer groups. I mean, Freedom Works is PAC. is new. FreeWorks is Dick Armey's Tea Party group. American Crossroads is not new, but they've gotten more involved in races. And if you looked at the Indiana Senate race, for example, where Richard Lugar went down to State Treasurer Richard Murdoch, Lugar outspent Murdoch by a massive ratio, I think, more than 5-1. But Murdoch almost got parity because of the PACs and super PACs and outside groups helping him. And this is the difference with the Democrats. I mean, Democrats have basically been able to slide through primaries this year without facing a challenge from an ideological liberal PAC. There's just nothing on the left that tries to enforce the same discipline. If you voted against the health care bill, if you're Larry Kissel of North Carolina or something, Democrats don't try to drag you down. The exceptions, I mean, actually, Sylvester Reyes was a Democrat who lost this year, but it was mostly because there's a PAC that really just existed to sow chaos and defeat incumbents. But there's not the same thing. Like, liberal donors are not as interested in purging the Democratic Party as conservative donors are. And the reasons are pretty numerous. The key one is that just there are not as many liberals as there are conservatives. Because of gerrymandering, there are lots of districts where Democrats win, but they win with a lot of independent Republican votes because a lot of black Democrats are kind of packed into Voting Rights Act gerrymandered districts. You know, I think I've seen polling where if Democrats win about 52-53% of the national vote for the House this year, they'd probably still lose the House because there's so many. North Carolina is a great example. I should focus on that because North Carolina, I just mentioned Larry Kissel. North Carolina is kind of carved up in a way where Republicans want to eliminate all but three Democrats. And this is a state member that voted 50-50 for Obama and McCain. If Republicans succeed, they'll have a 10-3 Republican to Democrat delegation. So there's not a lot of room there for Democrats to try and run a more liberal candidate in a swing seat. You know, instead, all the liberals are packed into districts around, basically rally around Charlotte, around the black areas of the state, kind of in a curve. There's a number, but just generally, I mean, I've been at this one in the beginning, just you find that liberal donors just don't like this system and don't want to contribute to it in the way the conservatives do.
Okay. We have full phone banks. Let's try and get through all the calls before we get to the top of the hour here, and we'll start in Holman, where Wayne is on the line. Wayne, good morning.
Good morning, John, and good morning, Dave.
Good morning.
I kind of come from a more conservative perspective, and I'm grateful to be on WPR. But I look at, for example, at Barack Obama's attempts, his fundraising efforts, along with David Axelrod. Their goal was to get to $1 billion. As I understand it, Barack Obama, our president, has attended over 150 fundraisers in the last 8 or 9 months,
mm-hmm.
and he's met with his economic council just once. And I'm kind of wondering, I know his priority as all candidates is to get elected, but, you know, his asserted goal when he was elected was to deal with the economy, get it hard, go after it, and fix it. Well, here we are, 41 months with 8.2% unemployment. So I guess I don't think he's been a very successful president, and I'm hoping that he does not get reelected and that we start fresh again. I'm just curious about what your perspective is on his fundraising efforts and kind of the lack of attention as to people who are donating to him, like Bill Maher, who gave $1 million and has probably got one of the foulest mouths I've ever listened to, but yet he won't give that money back, but criticizes Mitt Romney.
He says horrible things about women.
And I'll take my answer off the air. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with the idea that Bill Maher says some rotten things, but the fact we know his name, I think, kind of argues against what the caller was saying. I mean, some of these super PAC donors make themselves famous. What the Obama campaign, I'm not trying to spin for the Obama campaign here. I'm thinking of a way to say this that's kind of factual without making their argument. I know what their argument is. It's that because there's so much money going to the Romney side, the president has to spend a lot of time doing this. And the second argument they make that I'm pretty sympathetic to, because I cover Congress and it's kind of sad to watch it in action, it wouldn't really matter what the president does with a jobs council per se, because nothing's passed in the Congress. The president has a kind of bill, the jobs bill that he proposed in 2011, that's a combination of tax increases and spending increases and some cuts. And it is mostly frozen. Only a couple parts of it have passed. That is his job's plan to campaign move for the Congress. I think the weakness, and Republicans haven't really talked to, have talked a little bit about it. It's not part of their main message. Weakness is that he has had opportunities to really reform the system and hasn't done it. You know, when he had a mostly Democratic Congress, could he have implemented a tax reform quickly that might have been more stimulative? That's the missed opportunity I keep thinking back to. Could he have tried to implement the some of the Bull Simpson ideas when there was a lot of momentum for that in early 2011? That I think you're gonna, maybe you'll hear more of that because the fact that the way that the debt deal worked out, where there's a sequester just cutting a bunch of spending almost at random, could Obama have prevented that if he was more focused on, you know, like a real fundamental reform that would have irritated a lot of liberals but saved a lot of money? I think he could have, but that's not really. I mean, he's now fundraising a lot because he's not trying to move any of that stuff through Congress. I mean, it's. I don't think the fact that Jobs Council is not meeting is a reason to vote against him. The better question to ask is why he didn't take some of the recommendations by even some liberals early on and work on those. I mean, all these councils that are created, they're fun. It's fun to look at them, but I would love somebody to point out an example to me of a special presidential commission beyond the Warren Commission that actually achieved a lot. And even
well,
then,
and
that's
it,
controversial. Well, I'll get into that. But
yeah, and it's now and it now appears that that Mitt Romney will raise and spend more money than the president.
Right.
That's unprecedented. Let's take another call. We'll go to Madison and hear from Bill next. Bill, welcome. Oops, hang on, Bill. Let's get him. Bill, are you there? Did we lose Bill? Okay, well, let's go to Ralph in Little Suamico then, and take his call next. If I can figure out which button this is. Okay, well, apparently we have some problem with our phone system. The keyboard stopped working. In the meantime, I want to go back to what you were talking about with North Carolina. Are they likely to get in trouble with the Justice Department regarding the Voting Rights Act?
No, that's mostly been sorted out, actually. And the thing about the Voting Rights Act is that if you are drawing districts that allow minorities representation, then you're basically okay. Even I think the most egregious case recently was in Texas in 2003 when Republicans gained control and they decided to redistrict the state. And the only way the Supreme Court struck it down is in demanding they carve out one more minority district, not in saying, hey, the Constitution says you're not allowed to redistrict more than once every 10 years. So no, this North Carolina plan is basically going to stick. And you know, Democrats who controlled the state came up with a plan that was beneficial to them in 2001. This is just a general problem. This is why you even hear some Democrats complain about the way the Voting Rights Act, you know, makes it hard for them to win the House.
Hmm.
Beyond that, go ahead.
Well, we have Ralph now from Little Suamico. Our phone system is working. Ralph, welcome.
Yes. Am I on?
Yes, you are. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I hung on the phone, so it's a good thing I was thinking of hanging up. But I just had, you know, this is a little bit different angle, and I dislike the campaign ads as much as anybody. But I see in the paper today, $81 million spent on Walker recall election. That $81 million was spent for people that were employed by the campaign, for TV, radio ads. So it's money that went into the Wisconsin economy. And the fact that a lot of it came from corporations out of state should be a good thing because corporations are accused of sitting on trillions of dollars. So if we can get a few hundred million, it's all much better.
Well, Ralph, let me ask you just a question. How many of those radio and TV stations are there, do you suppose, that are actually owned in the local communities where they're on the air?
Well, I have no way of knowing. I guess, you know, you could say that maybe someone is employed now with WBAY or something because of that, but I don't have all the accounting on it. But the money doesn't disappear. If $81 million is spent, it's spent someplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. You actually don't hear people mention that very often, that there are, the media is often in trouble, and the media benefits when people spend lots of money on ads, on full-page ads, on TV commercials, things of that nature. The rates are actually going up, frankly, because there are so many huge, well-funded organizations that have already bought up a ton of time. And that's like, if you want one positive out of this, I think that's the one.
And if you want to identify a group that would strenuously oppose any limits on campaign spending, it would be television general managers, not to pick on them, but because they make a lot of money. Ralph makes an excellent point that money goes someplace, and so there's an economic benefit from having all this campaign spending. The super PACs are look like they're here to stay, absent some cataclysmic change, I don't know, maybe the world will end on December 21st. But it looks like they're here to stay. What effect are they? How much impact do you expect them to have on the presidential race? Is the super PAC spending more about what happens in congressional districts and state representative and state senate districts than it is on the national scene? Or will this have a big effect on the presidential race?
Oh, I think the big multiplying effect will be on congressional and senate races. Ohio is a good example, actually. In Ohio, Republicans have a pretty mediocre candidate, Josh Mandel, who's good at raising money on his own, but is 33 and looks maybe half that. Has made a bunch of mistakes. Had to give back $100,000 of a donation that was fishy, and he is being kept competitive basically because American Crossroads is spending a ton of money on him. Florida is a similar story, where Connie Mack IV, kind of getting pretty far on name recognition. Also, you know, he's lost local newspaper endorsements because he's seen as kind of unserious, has not been raising much money, but Crossroads has committed $6 million to that race.
That race, when you talk about committing for the candidate, what they're really committing to is against the other person.
Yeah, it's basically these educational ads that will be along the lines of Bill Nelson voted for Obamacare, Bill Wilson ready to raise your taxes in this way, call Bill Nelson's office and tell him you don't like that. And it's basically a negative ad that would help the Republican, but that fits under these rules. And again, in some years, I think somebody like a Bill Nelson, somebody like a Bill Nelson would be fairly safe because they've banked a lot of money, they've got a weak opponent. But now they've got this bruiser in the corner. It's almost like when somebody tags in a wrestler that's 400 pounds, and they can throw you around the ring and see if you survive.
Mm-hmm. We now have Bill in Madison with us. Bill, good morning. Thanks for calling back.
Okay, good morning, John. I want to know something about the mechanics of how and by whom super PACs are started. Is there a process? Is it a filing, like organizing a corporation? And is that stuff on record so you could begin to get an idea of who is behind these organizations?
Good question, Bill.
Well, they have to, super PACs have to register with the FEC. That's kind of what we're talking about at the start of the show. They have to issue occasional reports on who funded them. They can get delays. This actually came up in the Republican primary because John Huntsman filed for a delay, and it was a bit of a joke because everyone knew that the Huntsman PAC filed for a delay, and everyone knew that the super PAC helping him was basically funded by his dad, who's very wealthy. But they can get delays that kick him down close to the election. Reports will say something about how they're funded, but they can just say that a corporation or an entity funded them and not report on who the corporation is. So I think what you end up seeing in a lot of these reports down the line every quarter is a super PAC funded by some people who are well known and then some businesses that aren't very transparent. You know, there's a fun feature in a Mother Jones magazine, which is really intense on this story, that said the 20 richest people who donated to Romney's PAC, and they just meant people as corporations and listed, you know, corporations that aren't very famous but have maybe $500,000 to throw at a campaign or $100,000. So you find out something about who is funding the things. but not as much as you'd know otherwise. And certainly, you know, the old system used to restrict people to donating and used to cap it at, basically, if you max out the system, it's capped at around $75,000. Now this person can give as much as they want, and they can disguise themselves as much as they want to. There are some very proud people who have donated and, you know, declared their names, and you can find them. But they are, when it comes to the really big money, they're often the exceptions. But I would say this is confusing, so I'll just say like one last time that there's a super PAC, which has to issue something about who's donating them, and that can be covered up. And then there's the 501c3, which is secretive and doesn't have to say anything about who's funding them. And that's where you see a lot of the Americans' Prosperity, you see American Crossroads, you see those groups, they just don't have to say. I mean, when Bill Maher gives to the Obama Super PAC, he'll say it because eventually it'll come out. If Bill Maher were to give to a 501c4 organization, then you wouldn't, because that's under tax law. They don't have to say anything about who funds them.
All right, and that's a good place to leave it. Thank you very much, David Weigel, for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
David Weigel is a political reporter for Slate. This program was produced by Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, with production help this morning from Katie Mattson. I'm John Munson. It's been my pleasure to fill in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Rob Ferret will be along on Monday. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.